Hey folks, greetings from the Offensive Security Group here at Secure IT 360, coming at you with a new episode of the Cyber Threat Perspective. Today, we have some illustrious guests on the show today to talk to us about digital forensics and incident response. And as the title of this episode suggests, we're diving deep into digital forensics, incident respond. We're going to be talking about the roles, the various roles you'll see on a DFIR team. We're going to talk about kind of the psychology of IR and kind of what that looks like, the stages of incident response, challenges of cloud compromise, what comes after a breach, and a whole bunch more. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce the guests, and then we're going to get right into it. So first, I'm going to introduce Andrew. Andrew Caldwell is with CyberClan, and I'm going to let him tell a little bit about himself, his background, what he does, and then we'll switch it over to Mark.
Thank you. My name is Andrew, and I've been in the cybersecurity space for about 8 years now, running on to 9, CyberClan specifically a year. I've always kind of hopped around when it comes to the security domains and dealing with a bunch, but I've landed and found my love in digital forensics and incident response. It's where my passion is. It's where I hope to stay for a good long time, and it's really just the thrill of the hunt and getting into these sort of unknown scenarios where everything seems like it's on fire and bringing everyone back down to sort of ground zero and saying, it's okay, we're going to get through this.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Mark?
I've been leading IT teams and security teams since 2008. Really made the shift over to security around 2013, 2014. That's when I first got my SANS GIAC incident handler cert, which is kind of like the precipice. You really have joined defensive security when you start taking that particular type of course. I've worked for organizations large and small, usually on the private sector, running security teams, handling the day-to-days, everything from incident response to change control requests, third-party management, risk assessments, ISO. So I have a holistic view of an organization, and it's only in the last few years that I've focused more on the operational side. Joined Security 360 a year ago, and been working with the company since their inception. So knew what a great crew of people they were to come join. So focus primarily now on solely incident response. I've been a blue teamer at heart from day one. So it just seemed like a natural good fit for me to come on in.
Awesome. Yeah. I consider myself a blue hearted red teamer. A lot of the stuff I do is focus on how I can help the blue team from an offensive side of things. So that really resonates. So excited to have you guys on. The first kind of topic we want to dive into was the roles of incident response, kind of the DFIR roles, the various roles you would see on an IR team and what that looks like. So Mark, I'll turn it over to you. And then Andrew, if you want to jump in, we've got various roles, right? We've got various teammates. We've got various people who help out with incidents who you might see throughout. So for the IT manager, the CISO, kind of the security or CIO leadership, what are some of the roles that they should be kind of aware of and thinking about if they're in that IR situation and they need help? What are the various roles we're going to see here?
Yeah. So to parallel us, we consider ourselves emergency management. So think about when a fire department rolls out to a structure fire, who's on the truck? You got someone driving the truck. Someone who's the first guy off the truck with a hatchet in his hand to go running in looking for bodies, someone to secure the scene, someone to start the pump. But meanwhile, there's still an incident commander. So first and foremost, where Andrew and I tend to lead our teams is we're the ones coming in, starting to assess the entire situation while we have other people in our team, experts, looking at things. And we stay focused on the coordination as far as getting the who, what, when, and where, trying to get the facts of the situation so we can relay that to our teammates. And so they can start looking at things in a natural fashion without too much human contamination. Because in a situation like this, whether it's your house is on fire, someone's running out saying, help me, my dog's still inside. People are emotional and sometimes it's hard to get the facts straight. Is it one dog or two? Is it one system or two? Is it 5 accounts compromised? How many days have you done? How many hours? When was first detection? So our first job is the incident commander is to kind of come in, assess the situation, and really start slowing things down so our teams can start getting spun up.
Yeah, to echo that, the analogy of the firefighter is perfect, because you're not only dealing with the various different sort of aspects of getting water, getting your resources available to try and fight the blaze, but you're also dealing with the stakeholders. You're dealing with potentially a landowner, because this is a rental unit and now the landlord's on the fence. What about the rest of the units in terms of sideways and lateral sort of spread of more damage? Or to put a humor side to it, yes, my dog is in there, but then we go in and find a cat. Well, oh, I don't really care about the cat, so I didn't mention it. It's that simple case of people are thinking about their very top end needs, and they may miss things along the way. So that's where our job as incident commander comes in, is to try and coordinate amongst all the stakeholders, everyone involved from our side dealing with the fire to the people who are affected, as well as everybody in between is aware of what situation is for each stream, and getting that information out through an incident handler who's kind of like a project manager, but they're responsible for carrying our voice and the voice of others back to us so that everyone's on the same page.
Yeah, and when we were talking about this in pre-show the other day, is, you know, chain of command is a very important thing that comes into this. And we have response analysts, we have IR analysts, we have stakeholders, the incident commander. Let's talk a minute for how that chain of command works, why it's important, and why, you know, why it's important to have those distinct roles and to have a good reporting structure and have everybody kind of on the same page when it comes to communication.
Yeah. So besides the chain of command, probably a driving factor behind that is chain of custody. So one thing that we're very mindful of when we respond is, more times than not, an incident of cyber incident nowadays is either going to end up in civil court, criminal court, or a regulatory hearing. So we do want to do no further harm. We want to contain, we want to respond. And in order to properly respond, our teams need to know what are the rules of engagement from our side of the house, what are our systems of potential compromise, what's our time box of windows. And that information has to be precise, because an analyst going in thinking, oh, I don't need to look at the stove over here because that's outside my time box because they got the wrong information. Information could be missed. An investigation could be inadvertently trampled or not retained. So we're spinning multiple plates here as far as keeping the evidence preserved, but also trying to do an effective containment, effective service. And you can only do that with clear communication. The communication has to be top down. The guys in the trenches can't be talking over left and right to each other, like, did you hear that? What did you mean by that? Like, you have a single point of origin for your data and let that be your source.
And echoing that, it's very important to have that sort of chain of command, as well as the chain of evidence and everything just structured across so that everyone's on the same page. Because when you have these sort of lateral communications and sidebar conversations, that's fine, but decisions can't be made when it comes to that. Biggest example of that is taking one piece of information, thinking that you have to act on it, and rather than getting it up the chain of command to have that higher level overview from an incident commander, you're taking it off, running with it, and you may end up rushing and either removing evidence, destroying evidence, or putting yourself into worse situation. As an example of this, I've seen in the past where individuals have taken, oh, now I know where what the ransomware group is and it's the file extension. I've researched in this researcher on Twitter that has been actively trying to, going into the technical side and examples, they've been actively trying to decrypt this piece of malware. Just because that's the case doesn't mean you necessarily want to reach out and start getting all of the nitty-gritties of that, especially if you're in active ransomware negotiations. And this is where the critical piece of that is you don't want to have a sidebar conversation, oh, I'll just reach out and do that. And then all of a sudden you have that in the open public forum while the ransomware negotiation is underway. And all of a sudden the ransomware group goes, wait a second, you're trying to negotiate with me, but you're actively trying to get it for free. I'm done.
Yeah. And the other aspect is, to realize we tipped down a little bit. Part of this in responder and handler is we're managing the client. They're under tremendous stress. They're having a very bad day. And the communication needs to come from a single point and saying, here's what we have found. Here's what we are doing. It can't be from someone in the trenches saying, oh, by the way, I think I found this, or I think I found that. I mean, that's right. Good team collaboration in an investigation, but the person in the boardroom doesn't need to see that, hear that, because then they may not fully understand or draw a wrong conjecture. And then when we later represent something, well, I thought you guys found something, like, no. So let it come from a single point of communication.
Yep.
So it's kind of our own version of crisis communication, right? We provide when we provide information to someone in a crisis, it's factual, it's relevant, it's what they need that moment in time. And it's not, you know, whiteboarded ideas and mind mapping, like, well, what do we think about this? Like, no, here are the facts so you can make the best decisions going forward.
A critical piece of that, especially in the recovery aspect of an investigation, is when recovery is being taken. Oh, I found some backups from 2 weeks ago. Great. I can recover my data. Let's get it up. Let's spin it up, put it into production. We need to run. And it's a case of, whoa, wait, you haven't done the forensics portion to understand if there is a backup for the threat actor to get back in. So they've spun up, they've gone in. Yay, we're back in business. Oh, now we're double encrypted.
Yeah. And that ties a lot into psychology of incident response. And you guys touched on that in a couple places, especially when it comes to an analyst having information and kind of going outside the bands of how the communication should work or is designed to work and kind of communicating things. And now that gets into, leadership of being, you know, not understanding, maybe being paranoid that there's other issues going on that they're not aware of, or that they're not getting all the information that they need from the team. And now there's second guessing or lack of trust and stuff. So maybe speak to a little bit about the kind of the psychology side of this and why that's important to kind of to manage those relationships, manage those personalities, and kind of really understand and have empathy for the person on the other end of it, of like how we can best communicate and what we should communicate when, and kind of the psychology of it all.
So a lot of times when we're showing up, it's someone's bad day, right? Probably one of the worst days in an organization or someone's career. There's a lot of things going on that factor into this. Perhaps they've already been working this previously for 6-8 hours, a day or two, and it's just gotten to be too much for them. So they're already exhausted. Stresses are high because, you know, I personally don't think people show up to work intending to fail. So when failures happen, they feel the additional pressure. Oh my goodness, you know, this impacts my company, it affects my coworkers, or could be something as far as simple as, you know, we had this project to close a security hole and we just didn't get to it in time. And oh my goodness, and, you know, shoulda, coulda, would've, and they get stuck in their head, which means they're not focused at the task at hand. That's human nature. And a good part of our skill set is coming in and saying, we've got this and we need to slow down and do this methodically. So we do this once, we're not reinfecting ourselves or making sure that if we declare an area clean and secure that it is, we can only do so with clear minds. And so a lot of it is the psychology of letting know. You can get a lot of phone calls from senior management saying, you know, what's the latest, and saying, we will tell you when we have relevant information. We will tell you when we have something to report in interim. You should be focusing on X, Y, or Z. So we start telling them some tasks, things that they should be doing and focusing on while we focus on our part or engage the teams to handle their response.
It's always one of those cases, right? The emotions are running high, regardless of situation, be it a small breach, a medium breach, or we're talking worst case scenario. It's always an ego hit and a pride hit as well, from my experience. And you're talking to individuals who've been paying their mortgage doing this job for the past 30X years. Mm-hmm. And it's always fun to have someone come in going, okay, well, this is best practice. And maybe they have, as an example for myself, even, I've had 8 years worth of experience. I shouldn't be the one coming in saying these are the best practices. I get it. I understand. But that is not an ego hit. It's not something personal that is ever trying to be done. It's just the facts that you have been focused on other areas and aspects of your environment. We need your expertise in this environment, but we want you to take away the fact of what it is you need to think about next. You just need to act on what we tell you. And that's never always, that's always taken in either good light or bad light. I've hardly seen in between.
Yep. Yeah. And sometimes the Eagle hit, sometimes they're also rushed. And rushed plus, this might be the first time they're really handling a major cyber incident. I've been in a career long enough. I mean, I remember, you know, Melissa and the IDLU slammer virus and you know, all that from way back when. So handled breaches and worms in the past. So kind of not my first rodeo. But so, someone else younger in their career, this might be the first time. And they're like, oh, my God, this is it, this is it, this is it. And they're excited. The adrenaline hits. And when your adrenaline runs high, your focus gets narrow. And they don't have the experience to know, hey, don't go running immediately, turn off that server because you might have just unlocked the files that are now going to be encrypted. Hey, don't do this or don't do that. Just through lack of an experience and being so head down and focused, they aren't listening. They need someone who's experienced. Like, we do this all the time. We're going to tell you what to do. We're going to handle it in a safe manner so you can continue business. You want to learn? Great. We'll show you what needs to be done, but listen to us.
And a perfect example of that is not only just on the client side or the stakeholder side, where they're dealing with it, this is their baby and problem, but also from even our own teams, it's that rush of trying to get the next bit of information. I want to rush and be the hero, be the savior that's found the smoking gun. I get it. I've had those problems in the past where I'm just itching and I'm driving forward 24 hours, 48 hours trying. I know I can find it. That's where mistakes get made. So it's the psychology of IR when it comes to knowing when to slow down is also critical, because then you can slow yourself down, you can slow others down, and that is a skill set in its own.
Yeah, I just read yesterday, I was reviewing some of my notes from the SANS, the GCIH course, and there's a spot on there about note take, and it says, if you are taking notes and you can't keep up, you're going too fast. And I'm like, that is like insightful. Like, how many times we've been on a call taking notes and like, okay, I'm not capturing observation. If you can't capture it, you're going too fast. Slow down.
Yeah. What advice do you have for CISOs, CIOs, IT leadership for kind of letting go of the reins, so to speak, of the decision-making for their environment, at least during this incident period, right? Like, do you have any advice for kind of letting go and kind of allowing the experts to kind of come in and kind of dictate what needs to happen and when and how?
Some of that's going to be directed towards them already. You know, if they open a claim with cyber insurance is going to say, step aside, son, you know, we're going to handle this. You enlisted us and this is how it is. As far as management, you know, we just need to let them know that, look, we're here for a reason, and what you need to do in order to keep whatever decision tree you have going on with your organization, what's going on in this crisis, you need timely, relevant facts. And you don't have the experience to get that. Let us go get those facts and present them to you so you, your inside counsel, general counsel, senior leadership board can make the best decision, whatever that decision is. But, you know, again, Andrew brought up a great point that there might be internal people who want to be they want to put on the red cape and save the day. And they end up going down rabbit holes that don't go anywhere. They saw something in the event log and thought it was something that same date and time. Doesn't mean anything, but they wasted hours. And a lot of times in these instances, you don't have hours, right? You have hours to get restored. You don't have hours to continue hunting. And that's where the discipline comes in and say, look, we're going to provide you just the facts that you need to make the best decisions going forward. Your decisions may not be pretty, may not be conversations you want to have, but at least we're going to get you facts. So when you make the decision, no one's going to run out the door 10 minutes later and say, oh, by the way, we found this instead and never mind.
Right. Now I know there's probably people listening to this who have gone through this process before, who have gone through incidents, who've had breaches at their organizations or had account compromises and things like that, maybe even experienced ransomware. But for those who maybe haven't, maybe you guys can walk through at a high level, kind of what this looks like at a high level from a workflow standpoint. Like, what are kind of the main stages of an IR and kind of what does that look like?
So that is really easy to kind of go with, at least at the start. I always say, when was your last tabletop? There is the exercise when it comes to doing pen testing. Everybody knows that. Everybody likes to either get third party or internal teams to do it, and it's all fun. but when was the last time you went, okay, if everything is on fire, where, who do I call after my insurance provider? Because once you call your insurance provider, you're expecting them to pay, but they're obviously looking to see what is the evidence that that's the case, or are you just trying to bail yourself out of something? So when was the last time you did a tabletop? Do you have everyone on your sort of payroll and employee list know the internal security mailbox if you have an internal security team? If you have a IR retainer with a breach response vendor, do you have that contact and have that contact detail? Are they still answering within an SLA time? Having these sort of initial stages set up so that it's the break glass in case of emergency on the wall. Like if it's there on the wall, it's clear to see every employee, but if it's sort of subjective and kind of hidden within, you know, a wiki in an internal website, but every single website is down in your internal networks because it's been ransomware, well, it's a little harder. So preparing yourself is the best sort of first stage. Then it comes to getting your IR vendor in tune with what your environment is. So what security controls are in place, what's available to even tell and timeline the story. We're looking at that sort of initial first, like what are the standard victims or culprits of action? Internet facing servers, vulnerable services, users that may be click happy on phishing links or just like to plug in every USB device that they found on the floor. Whichever is the case, we look for the usual suspects because that's all we can do when it comes to coming into a network unknown. Then it's a phased approach. What does that evidence tell us about what happened at the incident and backtrailing as much as we can and go back from? And it's the phased approach. Okay, that points to the next host. What does that tell me? Next host, until you find hopefully patient zero.
Yeah, so preparation is the one part that people tend to skip over. And they usually tend to land square on identification, right? Somehow they've got identification, they know something happened, whether it's alerts going off or a ransom note on the screen of all their systems. So once they've identified it, then they figured out, okay, now what do we do? At this point, the cyber teams get rolling. We come in and the next part of that would be referred to as containment. Right? What can we do to make sure that whatever damage has happened is contained and doesn't spread, right? The firefighters, we show up to the house that's on fire and we start circling the house, watering all the hedges and the houses next door, making sure that fire doesn't spread. So that's our goal from there is to ensure containment. Containment may not be quick. Containment could be, depending on the severity, could be quite a long time. That's where some of the investigation begins because you know, we don't want to be, you know, sitting there, you know, digging in the beach and digging sand. We think we're plugging one hole and all the ones filling in, you know, so we make sure that if we are closing off what we think was the vector of attack, that we truly, we've got collaborating evidence that shows that's how they got in or that's how this is happening. We've got that closed because we don't want to, you know, keep this cycle going, right? And after that, then we start to talk about eradication. You know, once we've got it secured, that there's no more damage. Now we start talking about the actual removal of the damaged systems or what needs to be done along those ways. Those are usually the first three that four that gets the most attention up front. But preparation, you know, Andrew brought some great points as far as getting the statements of work up front. I'd also would recommend that if you got a third party IT service, someone provides you your VMware or your Cisco service, make sure you've got an SLA with them. Because most times in incident planning, IT teams may not be fully staffed, right? These incidents don't happen on Monday at 10 a.m. You know, could be the weekend, could be, you know, what if you're a small IT shop and your main IT guy is on a plane to Australia and he's out of pocket for 18 hours, right? Can you afford that to happen? So make sure you've got backbench ready, but also I would put some language in there making sure that if they're going to be called in, that they get some sort of priority preferential treatment, because if the next big solar winds hits and everybody needs remediation today to get this fixed, you want to be on the front of the line with your contract saying, "Hello, we paid for this to be first." You want to be sitting in, you know, now serving number 72 ticket. You know, you want to kind of put some meat behind it if you can.
Absolutely, and making sure that you get. Similar to the incident response and getting everyone on the same page, even before and prepping it, because you could have one sort of service provider dealing with the hardware, another for the operating system, and then another for the actual software and services running on that. So you've now got three potential third parties that all have to coordinate with each other. And if you don't have anything prepared for having them all work in the same order, you're pushing your time of action days, even weeks, because, oh, well, I don't have the resource this week, so I'll get back to you next week. Well, they can't start their work until you finish yours. So now I'm down 2 weeks.
Yeah. Having a good incident response plan moves the needle so much. It's one of those things that was, I should have an incident response plan, but you know, nobody plans to fail, but failure always comes from a lack of planning. And just having that conversation is like, okay, I'm going to write a document and it says, who do we call first? Well, I don't know. All right. Well, who responds? Who's on our call tree? Who's on the call tree? Like, just that exercise. And small organizations, this might even take you like less than an hour to just have that thought, because in the heat of the moment, you're not going to think clearly and you're not going to know, or you're going to just, you're going to be throwing stuff against the wall, and an hour preparation now will save you 8 hours later. And knowing that, you know, here's what we thought about that. Oh yeah, these systems, we need to call in this particular specialty group. We got to call in this group over here for these people. And just having that stuff ready to go. As Andrew said, the break glass, it expedites how quickly you can work on containment. If you're stuck in the identification phase and you're trying to notify everyone to respond for containment, if that window is long, more likely the damage is going to be more severe, especially with ransomware.
Yep. So aren't all compromises, aren't all breaches like SolarWinds, aren't they like all super advanced, super sophisticated, high tech, 0 days and fancy tools used by adversaries and like really high tech stuff? Or is that kind of a misconception that everything is just this super sophisticated attack that you see in the news?
I think I can't remember which report I just saw now. I think nearly 45% of the attacks now are using LOL bins and native tools like PowerShell. I've worked on a few investigations over the last year where there was no malware utilized. It was a total convince the user to let someone on their computer to download a file transfer utility. And all this person did was copy what was on that, their computer, and their computer was a mapped drive to the company resources, and just did copy off to some FTP server on the internet. I'm drawing a blank of the threat actor group that draws it and did that now, but that there is no malware. There is no virus. There's no Cobalt Strike, Metasploit. So the only way you can bolster against that is to have some sort of advanced desktop solution like EDR, just saying we only authorize this type of utility. Perhaps IT has a need for that. Or if you've got a staff member who utilizes FTP for some reason, because that's where a business partner is. But the moment another utility shows up on the workstations, fire off an alert, right? And do a custom IOC that anything else of these utilities show up, because they're not, you can go out to, you know, WinSCP and download it for free and run it. And you even, there's self-contained executable. You can have someone who's not an admin to the machine, because it's a self-contained executable. It will run without admin rights. And all it was doing was doing a giant robocopy, copy X to file server Y. That was it. That was the amount of the sophistication there. So it was not nation state level encryption on workstations, or you know, threat actors, you know, trying to take on the Pentagon. It was the old fashioned, you know, smash and grab.
I'm thinking of a big sort of notion that was happening last year with move it, move it. So, and even just a not even as sort of sophisticated as WinSCP, and even that is not even sophisticated, but just a simple tool that makes it easy for click and drag, where it's just simple security controls that can be put in place, multi-factor authentication on your sort of internet-facing services for remote desktop, because it's not just your users that may be giving their username passwords for their corporate account, but they're using the same corporate password for their personal accounts on LinkedIn, on any of the third-party services. And it's not a case of, oh, they're intending for this to happen, but it happens. Simple the main sort of areas that I do see malware being used in terms of a customization is not in the corporate environment, but in the personal side. So information stealers, because everybody has admin on their local personal machines and they'll end up connecting to corporate resources using their personal machines. It's through an approved manner, but you're at least giving that sort of keys to enter in, and having the latest and greatest security controls is going to be fine and dandy. But if no one is actively monitoring those and managing those alerts, if a tree falls in the woods, does it make a noise? Well, if an alert goes off and anybody actions it, is it a security risk?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, there's a quote that was really good that Mark, that you shared with me, from Sans Defer in August 2023. And it says, ransomware threat actors are very good at the basics, and this shows against companies that aren't. And I think that just echoes this point that, you know, both of you have elaborated on is, you know, a lot of times it's basic stuff. It's not super advanced. It's social engineering or credential related. And it's just not super high-tech stuff that these threat actors are abusing to get into these environments, to compromise accounts, to ransomware. You know, it's a lot of the basics. It's a lot of the best practices, you know, taking advantage of the lack of them thereof. And it comes down to that a lot of times.
Yeah, I keep referring back to the ASD top four. I think it's the top seven now, and it's the Australian Signal Directorate. They're the ASD is the, or they're the Australian equivalent to the NSA. And back when ransomware first hit, they did a study about, you know, what happened, and they came out with a report that said that if you did these four things, it reduced, there's like 87% reduction in the impact of the virus, or you were not, you know, there 87% chance you were not going to be affected. And those four things was not, you know, run out and buy CrowdStrike and go hire Mandiant to threat hunt your network on a daily basis. No, it was remove local admin, patch your operating system, patch your applications, and use a current up-to-date antivirus.
Yep. And by the way, all those things are great, right? You should have a really good EDR. You should have a SIM, and you should be monitoring, and you should have MDR if you're not big enough to have a SOC. And you should take advantage of services like threat hunting, and you should do pen tests regularly, and you should do risk assessments, and you should do all that stuff. But when it comes down to it, there's a handful of things that are like, if you're not doing those, you're going to have a really bad day.
And driving home that point of patch management for endpoints, the biggest key sort of failure that I've seen in the past from my experiences is not patch management for the stuff that's used constantly. It is the lack of decommissioning. So it's a case of, oh yeah, we've moved to the cloud for Exchange, but we still had the old Exchange server running from 2017. Okay, why is that still around? Well, we didn't think it was important. Well, Mr. Threat Actor thought it was very important.
Yeah.
I think what's changed is once upon a time, probably 10 years ago, smaller companies, mid-sized companies truly could get by telling themselves, I'm not big enough. It's not going to happen to me. So therefore, they didn't have to focus on the basics, or if there was cost prohibitive, you know, so they're just like, oh, it's not gonna happen to me. So here we have this pack of gazelles going by, and now the threat actors have changed. Then now, as long as you got access to a bank account, you're a target. That's the only criteria. If you have access to a bank account or access to an insurance policy, you're going to be a target. So now these smaller companies, which did not do the basics, or perhaps they've hired, you know, a small IT provider to provide them services, and they've been fine going along life just fine for 5 or 6 years. Now they don't think they are a target because I'm too small. No, you're not. And they can't shake this idea like, well, I can't afford a SIM, and I can't afford a security team, or I can't afford that. Well, you don't need to. If you can just focus on these four will carry a lot of weight. It's not your fault if the other person has a bigger gun in a gunfight, right? If he's got a longer range than you and a higher capacity, it's not your fault. But if you didn't load the bullets, that's on you, right?
And it's changed quite a bit with cloud, right? With cloud, with SaaS products, with shadow IT, there's a lot of challenges that come along with that. And we were talking about that previously. And you know, maybe we can speak to, because there's been some very high profile cloud breaches, right? With Microsoft, Google, I mean, you name it, some of the big vendors, big firms have had breaches, right? And some of them have been, you know, less sophisticated than others, right? Microsoft, specifically, they were a victim of credential stuffing in one case, and then like this complicated memory dump where they got access, and it was kind of a really sophisticated thing. So there's two extremes, but cloud and SaaS products and shadow IT, I can imagine, make responding to threats in those environments rather difficult and kind of challenging. So maybe we could speak to cloud, SaaS products, and kind of that ecosystem for, you know, what if my cloud document management system, I think, is compromised? Like, what happens? Do I have logs? Like, what happens?
So that boils down to, unfortunately, you're at the mercy of some of these cloud service providers and how they've configured their systems. We, in sort of the legacy sense of going into an environment and it being all on-prem, you've got a chance of exporting out the images, and those images for Windows file system, NTFS, hold some artificial artifact areas that you can extrapolate some information on, such as the MFT having a correlation of many files being downloaded to a, or created onto a hard drive at a specific time. Maybe they're deleted now, but that's certainly signs of potential data staging. With cloud, you don't have the disk. You can't walk up to Google or Microsoft in their data center with a rate blocker going, I'm coming in and where is my drive? Not going to find that. That's not going to happen. So you're at the risk or the mercy of how they've configured their environment. So if they don't have the auditable trail enabled by default when you set things up, then that information is lost.
Yeah. So a real challenge is also right now, there's no standardization amongst the cloud providers as far as how they're creating their logs or how they're treating them. Amazon has their security products that you can purchase and tap into, but that's for Amazon. Right. Google has theirs to a certain level. Microsoft has theirs. So responding to an organization that's, you know, has some on-prem and some SaaS and some infrastructure in the cloud, it can be very complex, very fast as far as trying to pull these logs in one spot and go through and correlate them. So that's a challenge that we have as responding. But the biggest challenge I think that we continually face is people have gone ahead and made the decision to transfer risk to the cloud for lower cost of infrastructure, transferring it, you know, that they don't have to worry about patching servers or they're paying for the someone else has gone forth and have made sure the data protections are in place for the European Union or HIPAA. They've transferred all that risk to this organization, but they haven't really gone into seeing the full capabilities and potential as far as security, as far as, you know, the features that can be turned on and enabled to bolster yourself, or, you know, what kind of detection capabilities are there? Can you have logs streamed to a SIM where you can at least look for login failures or logins from, you know, can you get something? So good news is smart companies are pivoting to the cloud and they're shedding the legacy stuff that Andrew mentioned is sitting, what used to be sitting in the corner is now totally gone, but they haven't fully embraced the full potential of the security there. And when something does happen, I guarantee you that cloud providers are going to be like, hey, we only provide security around infrastructure, authentication, and controlling the data that's on you. And they'll make sure that is thoroughly worded in every contract and disclosure that you sign up for.
And I don't want to put the onus completely on like cloud service providers that, oh, they're not logging enough. This is as well, I've come into certain SaaS providers, such as financial providers, talking Square, we're talking Stripe, we're talking PayPal. They may not necessarily know that that's a use case that they have to log for. So it's a case of, hey, is this, you know, the account transfer of where a potential terminal might point to another location? If I configure it at location for that terminal, fine. But if I'm doing it from the cloud, do you track that? Oh, well, we might not track that individually, but they don't have an answer for it in particular. And it's a case of, we just didn't know we had to track that. similar case to, I put the analogy for health services. Back in the day when smoking was very prevalent around, nobody was worried about their surgeon smoking in the surgery room. We know now that's an oopsie, but live and learn, right?
Yeah. So we talked about preparation a little bit earlier. What are some things you guys think that organizations should be thinking about from a preparation standpoint? Like, whether it's a tool, a technology, a capability, we touched on it a little bit. What are some things that organizations should be thinking out about prior to, you know, having to call in Secure IT 360, to having to call in CyberClan, something like that?
You know, the textbook response is usually, okay, get a business impact analysis and see how long your systems can be down before you need to be restored, before you start losing money, and a help prioritization in the restoration process. I'll distill it down even similar than that and saying that really what you need to do is see how the attackers are attacking. And this is all being very well documented through many resources and feeds. What I like to use and refer people to is like the Cyber Kill Chain out by Lockheed Martin. And basically it has all the steps of the adversary goes through, the six steps. And just as each step, you know, look at it and say, what control or what do I have in place that could stop that? Because the idea being is it's a chain, right? Step one is the bad guys found you. And step six is, okay, they've gone ahead and they've made impact. They've encrypted your systems or they stole your data, right? And there's steps in between. Stopping in one of those steps will get them before they get to the very end. So where, you know, what can you do? Take your infrastructure, take your security and line up on different pieces and look at it. You may find out there's some holes. Some of you might be very easily to remedy, and some of them might, you might find out that, oh, well, I've got the same tool as doing blocking step two and step four. Well, what happens if that tool fails, right? Now that person who's going to your network gets a head start. You know, like Bob Barker golf and The Price is Right. He's putting from the 1 foot line. He's not putting from 12 feet away for that car now, right? He's right there to, you know, and you thought, you know, well, I have this product in place. It's a single point of failure. What do you have behind that, right? Security, you use the analogy. And again, it's an onion. We need to have as many layers because with every layer of security, there's an opportunity for detection. And that is the name of the game for us. The quicker we detect, the quicker we respond, the faster we respond, the less likelihood of there being damage.
That's overall, that's the definitely what you want to end up doing. If we're ever to boil it down, the only thing I can say is, and just to echo the sentiment, is identification. You need to have your visibility. So if you don't know how to start off with those steps, you need to engage a third party for assistance in that. First things first, identification, visibility of what you have. Because this first thing that any company is going to ask you when they start applying that sort of layered architecture on is, what is it that I'm going to put that onto? If I put it onto a subsection of what you actually have, because that's all you remembered, but realistically it's all the way out here and we're missing all of that, there's a lot of security controls that might not be investigated or at least measured for how successful they are. And that's where I always boil down to the success of security controls. You want to try and find out, not do I have a security control in place for it, because that's great, but what is the success of that security control? Because in the security layered approach, if you have constant alerts popping off for the entire month of January, say, for endpoint detections, EDR is picking up macro-enabled Word documents that are being, you know, placed onto endpoints and trying to reach out to IP addresses outside of Canada to download malware. Okay, so how are these documents actually, so that's good that they're stopping at that stage, but in the cyber kill chain, is how is that document getting to that endpoint? Well, that's from the user downloading it from their email, their corporate email. All right, do I have a secure email gateway that's filtering these before it even hits the endpoint and allows the user to even click? Do I have security endpoint or user awareness training to be able to coach them? Hey, maybe shouldn't click every single document we receive. These sort of success measures for your security controls can at least point where certain security controls might be failing so you can improve and not remove them, but at least you're getting the full visibility and the full picture of what's going on.
So we've talked about preparation, which is great. And you guys touched on some really important things. I want to fast forward now. Like, we've gotten through an incident, right? Let's say, you know, we're past it. We've remediated. We've we've done what we needed to do, and we're back in business, right? We're kind of operating as normal again. What comes next? Like, what should I be doing after the breach? What's your advice for organizations who have just gone through a breach and now they're like, okay, we're in a stable state, but that wasn't very fun. I don't want to do that again. Like, what do I do next?
Unfortunately, often what happens is lessons learned, having the after action review where you sit down and say, okay, in a room that's safe, you know, and I mean safe, it's safe to talk. I'm not talking like, you know, soundproof, skiff and any kind, but it's more of a, okay, this happened, and have everyone talk through what happened, talked about the events, you know, and truly try to record, what did we do right? What did we do good? Where was an area of improvement? Where did we fail? And document that. Many organizations have that conversation and like, okay, but then there's no follow-up. Someone needs to be assigned that, okay, we've captured some areas of improvement. This now needs to go to management and saying, this happened because of X. We need a path to make sure X doesn't happen again. And we need you as management to check in with us every quarter or give us the resources we need to continue that happens. Because people will say, whew, man, good thing we had that security retainer and CyberClan came in and did a phenomenal job. And, you know, we're back up in business and man, you know, it was 2 weeks of no sleep, but man, we got it done. Well, if you haven't changed anything, get your sleep now, because in about a month or two, you're going to have it again, right? It's just going to happen. That's just the state of affairs we're in. And you need to have that management accountability and the management assistance, because without management, you know, obviously writing the checks for the technology, the services, the staff, all the resources, without them buying into it. But too many times management's like, okay, we're back up and running, you know, so it's kind of a, like, IT and security needs to get management involved, or management also needs to stay on security and say, okay, guys, you said this happened, you know, this is how it happened. What have you done to make sure this doesn't happen? You know, and those conversations need to happen and be tracked.
Otherwise, you're dealing with the definition of insanity. Oh, it just won't happen to me again. That's it, twice, no problem.
Yeah, lightning won't strike in the same place twice, right? Yeah.
No worries. Then, unfortunately, there is some instances of resurgence of customers, and I'm sure everyone's had that, and it's a case of it could be the same or a different, totally other outside of what was the original incident. That sort of, oh, I just have to set it and forget it, is a thing of the past. IT has never been a set it and forget it, even from an operational standpoint. Neither is security for IT services. It is always going to be, okay, we can get you to a, right now, good and clean strategy setup, and you're going to be good for until the next update for this software and services of your technology stack. So Windows comes up with updates every month, Patch Tuesday. Same with other services, same with other operating systems. It's just the workflow of life when it comes to IT. And that's why we have to keep on top of what's currently available for patches, why there are 0 days popping up for every other known instance. Secure Connect as a, or ConnectWise, had the recent one where everybody had to patch that. But if you're setting it and forgetting it, well,
yeah,
TikTok.
Yeah, and to add to the follow-up is, you know, some of these attacks we mentioned earlier aren't sophisticated. They didn't do any IT vulnerability. They exploited a human vulnerability, right? Someone got duped to download WinSCP and copy files off of the workstation. There are technical controls you can put around that, but truly goes back to user education and what is the company doing to make sure that security awareness training is fresh, current, relevant, right? Sending out a blanket email once a month trying to trick people into clicking on a link, telling them the FedEx package is late or the king of Nigeria wants some help. People are getting wise to that. You need to start tailoring your security awareness to what's going in the news, what's happening in the last 6 to 12 months. If it happened to somebody else, those emails are still being utilized by the threat actors. Can you get your people to start knowing those are the ones you should be staying away from? Because everyone now, we get the real with laughable spam nowadays. We all kind of laugh at that, you know, but once upon a time, they were the best of the best near tricking people, right? It took us years to get to that point now where we laugh at them, but guess what? With the more sophisticated emails, they're still out there and we need to be on top of that.
Yep.
And not even to mention the use of ChatGPT and crafting a lot of these. So you don't even have to worry about the misspelling or misconnect because you're getting an AI to generate a lot of this stuff. The one bit that I wanted to quickly touch on is rather than a perspective of IT, but the soft sort of post-breach stuff, you also have to worry about what it is that you have to maybe post about to your clients, as well as what you actually have to reach out to for your supply chain. So your vendors that you go to, if they know that you have a breach, are you good to connect up with? Are we still going to have the risk of business with you? Having your sort of written communication and everyone, this is what we say, is going to be very critical down the route. Because if you have someone explain a little bit too much that you maybe didn't want to explain to a certain supplier, now you've got a difference of opinions and you want to make sure everyone's just speaking the same tune.
Yep, for sure. Now, as we wrap up, Andrew, why don't you tell us a little bit about CyberClan, what you guys do, how you can help in this area, and you know, where to go for people who are interested.
Absolutely. So CyberClan has been a wonderful experience. I'm looking forward to many more years here. Our group is dabbling in everything of IT that is security related. So when you're talking I don't know where to go next, everything is on fire, we'll be able to assist with that. We've also been in contact with many insurance companies when it comes to other new things that are popping up. So the resurgence, or not resurgence, but the surgence of deepfakes and social media defamation. So whether or not someone behind an anonymous post can be tracked and identified, business email compromise, it's really just a case of we're a do-it-all kind of company, which I don't know if it's a good thing or is a bad thing, but it's an interesting thing. And what keeps me always coming up early in the morning to make sure what's next today, because I'm never sure what I'm going to deal with. I just know I'm going to have fun.
Awesome. And of course, Secure IT 360, Mark, if you wanted to share a minute how we can help from that standpoint, IR standpoint, and of course, Secure IT 360 partners with CyberClan, and I think we have a great relationship there, but if you want to share a little bit, Mark, about S360 and what we do there.
Yeah, so we're services only. We don't sell software, we don't sell hardware, so we're able to come in and talk to your organization, big or small. You've already made the decision in your technology stack. We have the experts to come in, whether it's, you know, Spencer on offensive side of the house or my team on the defensive side of the house. We have managed detection response, managed EDR. We have a virtual CISO. So we have everything you need for security, but we're not going to try to sell you a firewall. So we work very well with companies of all sizes and even their IT partners, because our IT partners don't feel threatened by us because we're not going to try to elbow out their sales. You know, they took a long time to sell them those Palo Altos or those the VMware licensing. We're not trying to do that. We're security only professionals. We live and breathe this stuff every day, and we work with our partners like with CyberClan. You know, Andrew and I just worked on a case together. It's quite fascinating. Wish we could share more about it, but it's one of those that maybe will end up on Netflix in the future. But it's a great company to work for, and I think it shows in the service and product we deliver.
For sure, for sure. And you know, anybody who listens to the podcast we've done, I don't know, we're at 70 or 80 something episodes now. This is 82. We've done a handful more than that with like news episodes and little bits and segments there. So what I mean to say is if anybody is listened to my content and listened to me on the podcast, you know that I don't throw in call to actions very often. So when I do, I try to make them very impactful. So if you do need help, reach out to CyberClan, reach out to Secure IT 360. We'd be very happy to help and help you get through kind of a bad day and get you to the other side better off than you were yesterday. I'm going to end with that. If there's anything we can help with, please feel free to reach out. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. So Andrew, Mark, thank you very much. We appreciate your expertise. It was a lot of fun. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Yes.
Absolutely.
Awesome. And yeah, so we release new episodes every Wednesday. You can find us at secureit360.com. And what's the website for CyberClan, Andrew?
CyberClan is cyberclan.com. We have, yeah, I think it's just .com. We're kind of situated in Canada, US, and the UK. So if you're at any one of those places and you want to get to us before something happens, or talk to us while something's happening, or even after something's happening, we're more than happy to make that call, help you out just as good digital citizens. We, at the end of the day, all of these situations are chaotic, but we're trying to bring some clarity to it.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys. Thank you for coming on. We're going to do this again. So if you're listening and you've got this far in the episode, let us know what we didn't talk about or any topics that you thought you would like us to cover. Anything interesting, any questions at all about incident response, digital forensics, anything we didn't cover, let us know. Shoot us an email, social media, do all that fun stuff. And we will see you next time, the next episode. Thank you. Appreciate it, everybody.
Thank you, Bert. Thank you, Spencer.
Yeah, thanks so much.